Good afternoon. My name is Andrea, and I will be your conference operator. At this time, I would like to welcome everyone to the Cost of Violence conference call. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question during this time, simply press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, press the pound key. I would like to now turn the call over to Ms. Andrea Peirce. You may begin.
Thanks. Hi, this is Andrea Peirce. I'm the Vice President of Communications here at the Center for American Progress. Thank you for joining the call about the economic benefits of reducing violent crime. The call today will be recorded, and by joining the call, you consent to being recorded as well. I just wanted to give you some quick logistical information. If you have any questions after the call that we don't get a chance to answer, or if you want to know some more information, Katie Peters is the contact here. Her direct dial is 202-741-6285, and her email is kpeters@americanprogress.org. The run of the call today is Donna Cooper, Center for American Progress Senior Fellow, Rob Shapiro, who is Chairman of Sonicon and the former Undersecretary of Commerce for Economic Affairs. He's also a principal advisor. He also was a principal economic advisor to President Clinton during the 1992 campaign and currently advises the IMF. After Rob, Kevin Hassett, the Director of Economic Policy Studies and resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute and former Chief Economic Advisor for the 2008 presidential candidate John McCain. And after that, former Mayor Mark Morial, President of the National Urban League, will join the call. Donna? Would you like to start us off?
Yeah, good morning. Thank you for joining us. CAP commissioned this report today as part of a series called Doing What Works. In Doing What Works, we identify ways to increase the efficient use of public funds, improve government performance, and to reduce the pressure on taxes, and redirect funds to where they can have a greater impact. This report is the second report where we're looking at the cost of violent crime in our communities. Last April, we released the auditing of the cost of the Virginia Tech shooting, which highlighted the cost of failing to close the gun background check loopholes and operational problems that permit mentally ill individuals to purchase guns and the cost of mayhem that can ensue. In this report, we asked two respected researchers from different sides of the political spectrum. Rob Shapiro, as Andrew pointed out, has advised Democratic presidential candidates. Kevin Hassett, also an economist like Rob, has advised Republican presidential candidates. These two respected economists worked together to investigate the impact that violent crime rates have on municipal budgets, local income, and property tax values, and demonstrate a strong causality between the reduction in crime and the benefits that accrue to city budgets and property owners. This analysis draws on national statistics and data provided by eight cities. It demonstrates that the measures that succeed in reducing crime have significant economic benefits for homeowners and local taxpayers. This report presents new findings, and it's an exhaustive review of data that is based on locational information about where crimes occurred in these eight cities and looking specifically at a broad spectrum of national research and real estate data research to draw its conclusions. I'll start with Rob.
Thank you, Donna. Kevin and I undertook this project last year in order to examine and analyze and understand the costs of violent crimes, both nationwide and in a sample of eight major American cities. The purpose of that was to be able to estimate the savings and the other benefits that would accompany significant reductions in those crimes. Our analysis of the eight major cities really broke some new ground because it drew on multi-year data that pinpointed both the incidents and the locations of the four major violent crimes, murders, rapes, assaults, and robberies. These data were provided to us by the police departments of Boston, Chicago, Dallas, Houston, Jacksonville, Milwaukee, Philadelphia, and Seattle. My colleague, Kevin, will talk about how we use those data so that we could relate changes in violent crime by location to changes in property values in the same location. The report really produced a series of major findings. Apart from the issue of housing values, our major findings include the fact that despite the fact that violent crime has fallen by 50% over the last 20 years, a real achievement, these four violent crimes across the country still cost Americans nearly $200 billion each year. That includes $46 billion in direct costs for victims' out-of-pocket medical costs, for their property losses, for their foregone earnings when someone is injured and can't work for a while, or worse, when someone is murdered and we lose a lifetime of productivity. It also includes the costs of the criminal justice system for these violent crimes, which is the cost of policing, the cost of courts, and the cost of corrections and incarceration. It also looks at the foregone income of the criminals in jails and prisons, who otherwise at least would be earning minimum wage. It also looks at the losses of revenues for city governments from these lost earnings. When residents of the city of cities, whether they're the victims of crimes or perpetrators of crimes, are in effect taken out of their jobs because they've either been caught and incarcerated or because they've been injured, their income goes down, and that means that city revenues go down with it. And on top of all of these direct costs, violent crimes also carry unusually high indirect intangible costs. And this is really mainly the pain and suffering of victims, though it's also the pain and suffering of the families of victims. It also, other intangible costs include increases in insurance rates when violent crimes go up and reductions in investment in high crime areas. But even looking at the major areas of pain and suffering, economists estimate that violent crime today imposes over $150 billion a year in those indirect costs to people. And those indirect costs, that pain and suffering, is, of course, closely related to the foregone earnings, that while people are recovering from crimes, they can't work and they can't generate income for their families, and cities can't generate revenues by taxing that income. So it's clear then that reducing violent crime would produce a series of savings for both citizens as well as city and state governments. If we look at the at these direct costs, we set aside the issues of investment and pain and suffering, and also set aside the impact on property values, which we'll come to in a minute. If we just look at those direct costs, a 10% reduction in violent crime, which is a small increment of reductions we've already achieved. This is something that could absolutely be done, would reduce the costs for municipal budgets by, for example, $5 million per year in Boston, by $24 million per year in Chicago, by $17 million per year in Philadelphia. A 10% reduction in violent crime also would reduce the cost that victims bear by more than $7 million a year in Boston, $43 million a year in Chicago, $30 million per year in Philadelphia. By also avoiding the associated intangible costs to the victims of violent crime, the 10% reduction would reduce the total costs of violent crimes, for example, by an average of $145 per resident in Boston. In Chicago, those savings come to $187 per resident per year. And in Philadelphia, they would come to nearly $240 per resident per year. I think this analysis provides an opening for us to think about the current fiscal problems in a third way. That way goes above and beyond or beside the traditional routes of raising taxes and cutting spending. The fact is that we can find savings by reducing crime without cutting. I'm now going to turn to my colleague, Kevin Hassett, who will take us through the analysis of the impact of reductions in violent crime on people's property values.
Thanks a lot, Rob. This is Kevin Hassett. I worked with Rob on the study examining the impact of violent crime on property values, and I'd like to begin by thanking the Center for American Progress. I think we're exactly at a moment in history where seeking bipartisan solutions to things is the right approach, and I think this is, study has been a very prosperous first attempt in terms of finding important new facts that can help us think about policy that could hopefully lead to policy changes down the road that'll lead to bipartisan support. I really look forward to working again with CAP in the future. You know, people, as Rob mentioned, often focus on the tangible direct benefits to taxpayers and city government of crime reductions. And our research shows that very large positive effects on property values also need to be weighed in when you're considering the costs and benefits of expanded crime prevention. We use crime and property price data from five major American cities to test and identify the causal effects on residential property prices of decreased violent crime. We had what Rob and I would like to call a very cool data set that took a lot of time to get, but we have basically pinpointed crimes in these cities, and then we've been able to see what happens to prices in neighborhoods when there's variation in the frequency of crimes. As noted earlier, by combining average numbers of homicides in these cities, we find that about a 10%, using regression analysis, we find that about a 10% reduction in homicides corresponds to about a 0.83% increase in residential property values and prices in the following year. That means, again, just to put it in a different perspective, a 25% reduction in homicides in these cities would push housing prices up by nearly 2.1%. And so that means also, given that once we have these effects of how if you, have a murder in your neighborhood, the prices go down, or if you reduce the number of murders in a neighborhood, the prices go up, we can estimate the impact on property values in a, say, city, if the city were to make investments to reduce crime. And at the high end, we estimate that about a 10% reduction in homicides in 2010 would have increased, say, and we give an example of Jacksonville, would have increased housing prices in Jacksonville so that the stock of housing in Jacksonville would have increased in value by about $600 million. And in Boston, the same estimate for that reduction was about $4.4 billion. We have a wide range of these estimates for the different cities, but the basic idea is that crime has a big negative effect on property values, and crime reduction is, probably, if you do a cost-benefit analysis, going to be a really good investment that should attract bipartisan support because the impact on property values is very statistically significant and very large. And, I think that with that, that now we turn to the point in the call where I'd like to turn it over to the mayor, who will talk a little bit, I think, about his own very successful experience at going from like the desire of reduced crime, the objective of reduced crime, to actually accomplishing it. Mayor Morial?
Yeah, thank you very much. And let me thank all the members of the media for joining this call. And I also want to thank the two authors of the study for really not only digging into something that's intuitive and self-evident, but really documenting the impact that violent crime has on cities. I want to do a couple of things. The first thing I want to do is affirm and indicate and emphasize that violent crimes usually take place with handguns. Handguns are responsible for almost 70% of all homicides and 40 to 50% of all robberies. They are committed with handguns. So we're talking underneath the problem of violent crime. We're talking about a challenge with guns, easy access to guns, the use of guns, particularly illegal guns, in the commission of felonies in urban communities. Number two, I think New Orleans in the 1990s may have been a case study on what the positive impacts of violent crime reduction could have on a community. And in New Orleans, when I had the great opportunity to serve as its mayor from 1994 to 2002, we experienced a 60% reduction in violent crime over a period of about 5 years. Undergirding that were substantial investments in policing, substantial investments in the criminal justice system, and, very importantly, substantial investments in youth programs, youth recreation, after-school programs, and the like. And we always thought that those investments could, in fact, bring about a return on investment, and that the return on that investment would be that we would have lower crime and, therefore, increased property value, lower crime, and an improved economy. Because one of the challenges we were facing from a business climate standpoint was that the reality of violence, the reality of crime numbers, and the perception of those numbers had been a drag on private investment, a drag on business expansion, a drag on aggressive growth in the hospitality and tourism sector of our economy. With the declines in violent crimes, home ownership rates improved, home values improved, the tourist economy dramatically expanded. Not only did we have the reality of reductions in violence and crime, we had the reality of being able to talk about the changes that take place. It's important to recognize that the experience that cities face with respect to investing in policing and public safety have almost become what are called cardinal rules of municipal budgeting, that you prioritize policing and crime fighting, you place public safety at the top of the list. No doubt, that's important to put public safety at the top of the list. But pressures to continue to fund policing take away money from schools, infrastructure, and they place upward pressures on taxes and fees and revenue measures. So the reality at the city level, someone sitting in a city, in city government, being a community leader or a local business leader, is that guns, illegal guns, and access to those guns, combined with what it does when it comes to the violent crime rates in these communities, does have far-ranging impact on fiscal and economic policies at the municipal level, on the reality of neighborhoods, on the reality. The other thing that the numbers may not capture is what I call the quality of life atmosphere that occurs in urban communities. And what do I mean by that? You know, in urban communities, the idea of people sitting on their porches, sitting on their stoops, walking in the neighborhood, children playing on the sidewalks and in the streets, all of the things that define urban communities, those quality of life features are negatively impacted by violent crime. It lessens the bonds between neighbors, the sense of neighborhood and community that exists in all of these communities, the Bostons, the Philadelphias, the New Orleans, the Baltimores, the older cities where people live close together. I might also add that while this study does not reach, it reaches a set of urban communities, I think that the experiences that these two researchers found would be, in fact, the rule for urban communities, both big and small and medium size. In our work here at the National Urban League, we have a network of 97 affiliates. So I get an opportunity to visit cities big and small around the country. And I'm struck at how many times the problems of what were considered to be old suburbs, small cities, mirror the challenges, particularly when it comes to public safety and violence, of our nation's largest communities. So I think the research is right on point. I think the reality and the experiences that I am familiar with certainly demonstrate what the real corrosive effects from an economic and a fiscal standpoint, increased gun-related violence. And I think from a public policy standpoint, it's difficult to have sustainable change when it comes to violent crime without dealing with the difficult challenges we face with easy access to guns and the proliferation of illegal guns. So I'll be happy to respond to any questions from anyone.
Great. Operator, can we now turn it over for questions?
Yes, ma'am. And your first question comes from the line of Michael Hinkle with the Philadelphia News.
Donna Cooper available to take a question?
Yes, Michael.
How are you doing, Donna? You know, I was looking at this report in Philadelphia, I guess, if you talk about a 25% reduction in crime, you're looking at, my quick math here was $4.4 billion in direct and intangible costs. Now that's such a big number, it's hard to get your arms around, but I believe one of the authors of the study said that this cost the average resident $240. Is that just in total cost, or is that just the intangible cost per year?
I'm going to have Rob Shapiro answer that since he crunched the numbers for you, Michael.
Right.
Okay.
Well, the 10% reduction that produces benefits of $240 per year, that does include both tangible and intangible. The 25% reduction reduces government costs and other costs by almost $600 per resident. However, when we look at just the savings for the government and set aside all the intangible benefits, so that we're just looking at lower police costs, lower corrections costs, and higher revenues from less foregone income from victims and perpetrators, a 25% cut would enable Philadelphia to reduce its local property taxes by 11%. It would, or alternatively, it would allow Philadelphia to double its spending on housing assistance and the homeless. So these are real effects. It creates new room in municipal budgets to either relieve the burden on homeowners or to respond to pressing social needs in the community.
Michael, this is Donna. I also want to add, for the benefit of anybody else on from Philadelphia, that a 25% reduction in violent crime in Philadelphia would begin to bring the city's crime rate in line with the other cities in this study. So it's while very difficult to do for any city to drive down crime by 10% or 25%, what we find in this study is that Philadelphia, unfortunately, continues to be an outlier in terms of the rate of violent crime in the city.
Though it's very hard to bring down crime rates that much quickly.
Correct.
But we know we can bring them down gradually. These are long-term commitments that over a series of years can make real differences in the quality of life and the constraints on city budgets.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask an audio question, please press star, then the number one on your telephone keypad. You do have a follow-up question from the line of Michael Hinkleman. Your line is open.
Rob or Donna, so the murder rate, unfortunately, is up again in Philadelphia this year, and it's up quite a bit. And interestingly enough, the city's about to pass a budget, and it's probably going to include a small property tax increase as well as an increase in the use and occupancy tax that businesses pay. So can one fairly draw a straight line from this increase in the murder rate to what's happening this year with the budget? They want to take a stab at that?
Well, Michael, I'll just start very specifically. Part of the reason that you're getting an increase in your city budget, as you know, is because you have a $40 million increase in the amount of money that the city is going to pay the school district. So I don't know that 100% of the tax increases locally could be attributed to the rate of violent crime. But what this study does show is that if we can reduce the crime, we have greater property value, which would reduce the pressure on taxes. So I think the cause and effect in Philly on our tax increase at this point, so integrated to the school district, may remove the linear analysis that you're looking for. But the sort of counter analysis to that is, if our crime rate was lower, would we be able to ameliorate some of the need for the tax increases that are being proposed? And I think the answer on this study suggests that is yes.
Though there is one way over time that there certainly is a direct relation, and that is the relationship between crime and property values works in both directions. An increase in the crime rate in a particular area, say a zip code, will drive down property values more than that is relative to what property values are doing in other parts of the city where the murders do not occur. So that increase in the murder rate is depressing the value of the whole property base on which local taxes are based. So it has a very clear and definite effect.
Michael, I'll also say one other thing for the benefit of any other reporters from other cities. In the case of Philadelphia, a considerable portion of the policing, court, and incarceration costs are entirely on the city budget. In the case of Boston or Milwaukee or other places, some of the accrued savings from the reduction in violent crime will accrue to county or state government as well as local government. So their ability at the local level to direct the savings to a property tax reduction or city government increases will be mitigated by the fact that the savings go to other levels of government as well. But certainly in Philadelphia, with the exception of murder, which typically is going to serve state crime, for the other violent crimes that we track, those savings are going to accrue to the city.
Yeah, this is Kevin. The one thing I'd like to add to, I just did a back-of-the-envelope calculation, and to put it in perspective, a 10% reduction in homicides in 2010, given the table in our paper, leads to an increase in property values of about $3.2 billion in Philadelphia specifically. And given once that feeds through into assessments, given the tax rate of around 4%, you're talking well north of $100 million in extra revenue from that.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's our last question. I would like to now turn the call over back to Ms. Andrea Peirce.
Thanks, everybody, for joining. And again, if you guys have any follow-up questions or anything else you'd like to ask about, we'd be happy to answer. Katie Peters is at 202-741-6285 or kpeters@americanprogress.org. Thanks again for joining the call.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes today's conference. You may now disconnect.